Sirens are sounding, people are cheering and waving.
However extraordinary it may sound, more men have been in outer space or climbed Everest than have sailed non-stop around the world. It was a London map seller who showed it might just be possible to sail this way around the globe. Francis Chichester made just one stop. Inspired by his voyage, nine men set out to do it without any stops. Only one would make it back.
It's on a par with Sredman Hillary and Sherpa Tenzing scaling Everest. It's on a par with Roger Bannister, because they are records that can never be taken away from them. I mean, they were pioneers.
Beyond the intense rivalry to be first, it wasn't a race as such until the Sunday Times, imbued with over-enthusiastic checkbook journalism, announced prizes for the outright winner and for the fastest circumnavigation. Along with the majority of weekend sailors, I was both fascinated and fearful of the prospect for anyone intrepid or mad enough to accept this challenge.
To be honest, I think it was a little bit insane. That's the answer. It's insane, really.
I wasn't mad at all. I was a highly experienced seaman, a very well-trained navigator, setting off in a small boat, which I knew.
The whole time, you're only a quarter of an inch away from death, just only how thick the old hull is.
We were very fit. We were young warriors. We were very arrogant.
John Ridgway and Che Blythe, who 2 years earlier had rowed the Atlantic together in an open boat, were the first to sail. Ridgway on June the 1st, Blythe a week later. And both departures were eventful in their own way. Blythe's because he extraordinarily had virtually no sailing experience. Ridgway's because his yacht, English Rose 4, was struck by a television launch jockeying for a better camera position.
When it hit it, the mast sort of attempted to do a sort of S shape. And so on the opposite side from where it was hit, the chain plates that hold the mast up were damaged. So that cracks appeared in the deck. It was obviously not very strong. But being weak and ineffectual, I sailed on. I suppose what I should have said, well, I think I'll go back and have this fixed. But this wasn't a place where you could have this done, really. So I sailed on, and I always thought, well, you know, I'd find a way of fixing it by reinforcing it underneath. But actually, you know, it was not a very good idea to be in a production family Tupperware bilge keel boat, particularly when the only member of crew was so weak and ineffectual. had he been of sterner stuff, he might have got a bit further, but I don't think not very far. Well, he'd be dead if he'd gone much further.
I didn't see it as being a major problem, the fact I couldn't sail and couldn't navigate. After all, if Columbus could do it, what the hell was so special about him? Why couldn't I do it? Certainly it was interesting. A plan was that this chap would, in his boat, which is 36 foot long, he would sail in front of me and I would sail directly behind him. Although he had a crew on board, I was sailing single-handed. And the plan was that he would sail out through the Solent, having crossed the start line at Hamble, and I would follow directly behind him. And when he tacked, I would tack. And wherever he went, he'd make sure I was in safe water, so I didn't have to worry about navigation or anything. He would then turn back and go home, and I would carry on sailing. My plan was quite simple in that I'd sail towards Madeira, and Madeira was going to be the point where I'd confirm that by then I'd been able to navigate. And on finding Madeira, I'd be okay. If I didn't find Madeira, then the plan was simple. I'd turn round and come back and start looking for Britain.
Che Blythe. Barely a week later, Robin Knox-Johnson set sail from Falmouth in Suheli, a 32-foot ketch he'd had built in India while serving in the Merchant Navy. His departure was uneventful, but it wasn't long before the teak vessel started leaking, which meant diving under the boat to make running repairs in shark-infested waters.
Yeah, one came along, and I shot him because he was holding me up. And they're scavengers, you see, so I threw some lavatory paper in the water, and when he came up for it, just enough of his head came up for me to get the bullet doesn't go far underwater, and I needed to get him close or on the surface. So he came up to the surface, bang, straight in the brain. I tried corking it underwater, which is actually extremely hard to do. I then tried tacking a bit of canvas with some corking in it, which would be sucked into the seam and sort of block it, but sort of fothering is the word we use at sea, but that didn't really work. In any case, I thought it'd get ripped off. So I then cut some copper that the people had fitted the radio lift on board and knocked holes every inch along the edges and went down and started tacking it along the garboard. It was one breath down, tack if you're lucky, up, down, tack if you're lucky, up, down, tack if you're lucky. I mean, it took a long time to do. But what was the choice? The alternative was to pull out.
Robin Knox Johnson. Ridgway, meanwhile, was suffering structural problems of his own. The damage sustained in the collision with the TV launch had worsened despite attempts to repair it. And, as Ridgway readily concedes, it wasn't just the fibreglass hull that was cracking up.
As I remember it, I think I was in tears on some part of every day of the 50 days. I felt very, very ill-assorted to it. So after a while, you have to think, well, what are you going to do? And with great sadness, I thought, well, better live to fight another day.
English Rose 4 and her skipper sailed into the South American port of Recife and out of the race on July the 21st. It left Ridgway's former rowing partner, Che Blythe, in the lead. His yacht, Dytiscus 3, was, like Ridgway's, bilge-keeled, with two shallow ones side by side, and as such, totally unsuited to the race, as Blythe discovered in his first gale, when she'd turned suddenly into the wind and broach.
Chichester wrote about having a broach once in the Southern Oceans. I broached 3 times in 1 hour and 11 times in 1 day and thought this is normal sailing. The thing about a gale is it tends to be really quite clear and it's really, you know, quite pleasant. I mean, you have the sun beating down and it's really very, very lovely indeed. And I'm surfing along quite happily and suddenly the boat turned at 90 degrees to the wave and, I mean, I knew nothing about this or had no idea and I was in the cockpit. And if you imagine, suddenly the whole thing turns in a fraction of a second, 90 degrees, then the wave comes along immediately behind it and whacks you. The whole boat is then heeled over to such that the mast end is about 90 degrees or level with the surface of the water. And the wave is by this time is crashing over the top of you. You've got to hold on because if you're not holding on, you're going to be taken out by the wave. And in these days, you didn't really bother too much about safety harnesses. And then when the wave passes and the boat bobs up and sits upright, then of course if the sails at the wrong angle for the wind, they're crashing, banging, they're shaking and stuff. And you've got to then try and get the boat to turn and get back on track. But of course you've got no steerage way, so you have to get the sails in and there's a lot of energy being exposed then. You really work very hard to get back on track. And you've got to do this sort of straight away. You haven't got time to think about it and stand there and say, well, you know, what the hell happened? You've got to get that boat because all the time the sails are shaking and banging and crashing all over the place, there's potential damage. The one thing you don't want, and when you're sailing single-handed for any long distance, is any damage.
As Blythe pressed on towards the Cape of Good Hope and the prospect of heavier seas, 3 more yachtsmen entered the race. Bernard Moitessier and Loic Fugeron, both French, and retired Royal Navy submarine commander Bill King, at 57 the oldest competitor. Now 92, King recalls Moitessier teasing him about the absence of guardrails on his revolutionary yacht.
But Bill, you will spend most of your time in the sea. And then I showed Bernard my invention, which was 2 jackstays hauled very taut either side of the mast, the whole length of the deck, and round my waist a little rope with a clip hook. So I was always clipped on. And he approved of that. Yes, he liked that.
Bill King. Several thousand miles to the south, Knox Johnson and Blythe were being battered by the mountainous seas that, unhindered by land, can build up in the Southern Ocean and capsize a yacht in an instant.
It's a sort of roar, and it's an awesome roar, and it's a frightening roar, to be honest with you, because you don't know how your boat's going to survive that. So when you hear that coming, you almost flinch, because you know it's going to hit the boat. And it then roars, and suddenly the sound's all around you. It's everywhere. The whole boat's engulfed with this noise of the break, this breaking wave, all over it, under it, round it. Yes, it is a sort of roar, but roar isn't really the quite the right word. I see roar as something slightly more focused and specific, like coming from a lion. This is a roar from everywhere, and it's completely engulfing. The initial reaction is, what the heck's going on? Because everything's falling on top of you from the other side of the boat. Then you say, God, she's going under. I must get up. So you start trying to get up. And at that moment, she's swung upright. And of course, I was flung across the cabin and banged my head the other side. Right, she's come out too quickly. Must have lost the mast. Rushed around, trying to find a torch. Eventually found one and had a look, because it was pitch black outside. And mast seemed to be in place, but I couldn't tell for sure, so I had to get up and feel my way around and make sure all the rigging was tight, and that told me the mast was all right. Initially there's fear, obviously, because fear is of the unknown, and so the initial thing is, what's happened? Then you realise what's happened and you start calming down. That's the first time. When it happens again, you're not so frightened because you've been there before.
Though every bit as tough as Knox Johnson, Che Bligh's yacht was proving less durable. Despite reciting Rabbi Burns to spur him on, he decided discretion was the better part of valour, and on Friday, September the 13th, asked for a tow into the South African port of East London.
Very tough to accept that sort of thing when you're as arrogant as I was at that age. Up until that period of time, it never really happened to me. Everything we set out to do in a Paris or something, no matter what it was, we have achieved perhaps not all of the goals completely, but certainly maybe three quarters. Sort of failure didn't come into the vocabulary at all. So having to say you're going to pack up was really quite difficult and such a major blow. And if it had a major blow, I suppose that vanity was a large part of it, you know, thinking, you know, goodness me. You know, is this going to be the pattern for the rest of my life? Am I going to have to jack in every other voyage I attempt?
With Blythe and Ridgway out of contention, one might have expected the former rowing partners to get together, if only to compare notes on their latest adventure. But Ridgway had been needled by Blythe's entry into the race, animosity that continues to this day.
I think, you know, having been an adopted person, Che was probably as close as I ever came to anyone in terms of sort of friendship, and for whatever reason he didn't tell me he was doing it, and it upset me very, 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 very deeply.
So I tried to lighten the moment by sending him a telegram, and I sent him a telegram to say, who dares wins, who cares who wins. It's a sort of a bit of a joke on the SAS motto, what he said when he got the telegram, I can't imagine.
And it was just one of those regrettable things, you know. I haven't really spoken to the chap for 35 years. You know, you probably think I'm pretty wishy-washy, but probably I'm not quite as wishy-washy as you think I am.
They were pretty inexperienced. One person worried me. There was only one person there I thought was a serious threat, and that was Bernard Mattesier, because he was so experienced. And he had a bigger boat and a faster boat. So, competition.
October the 31st, 1968, was the closing date for entries, and before it was over, saw the departure of the last two competitors, Italian Alex Caruzzo and British inventor Donald Crowhurst, who saw the voyage as a good way of publicising his latest design, a radio direction finder called Navigator. Craig Rich was the Sunday Times navigation expert.
I think there was a financial problem there, and he saw this not only as a challenge, but as a means of perhaps getting himself back on the rails financially, and very good publicity for his Navigator, which he'd use on there, this handheld a radio direction finder. He did trials for the boat. It didn't quite work out. I don't think he had sufficient backup people. It should have been tested more. But no, she wasn't right.
I have never put to sea in such a completely unprepared state in my...
At about the time Crowhurst was talking into a tape recorder given to him by the BBC and lamenting the state of his trimaran, Tynmouth Electron, so Bill King was encountering a storm of the like he'd never seen during half a lifetime in submarines.
She turned upside down, completely upside down, paused for a moment, and then came back the same side. I was in the cockpit with the thing over, braced, coiling down a rope, in the best possible position to sustain a rollover, so I wasn't hurled about. Otherwise, one could have been badly injured. What caused it was a phenomenon called clapotis. Now, this is what happens. It's blowing hurricane force, and then the wind went through 90 degrees. So it blew hurricane force at 90 degrees to the old sea. So you've got 50-foot waves going that way with a huge distance between them and other 50-foot waves going at right angles to them. And where they meet, they erupt into a sort of pinnacle. You get a sort of pinnacle of water. We'd anticipated a disaster and had put in a jury mast. And all I had to do was to get this up and then hoist a jury sail on that. And with that, slowly crept back to South Africa.
King's retirement from the race and Fougeron's decision to quit after being battered by the same storm meant there were now just five competitors left spread over 15,000 miles of ocean. The Italian, Carozzo, was the next to go, forced out by an ulcer. At about the same time, Knox Johnson was suffering his own medical emergency.
I looked it up in the ship's captain's medical guide, and the symptoms I got meant I was either pregnant or I got appendicitis. And I came to the conclusion that it was probably the latter. And, you know, it said, seek medical assistance. Well, yeah, that wasn't going to do much. I had no radio. So I went on to a slop start, you know, porridge with milk in it. All I had was condensed milk, obviously. Anything, you know, bread soaked in milk, that's all I ate for about 3 days. I was absolutely doubled up in pain. I mean, it's hard to describe how painful that is. And perhaps the worst part is not knowing what it is. You know, your imagination runs riot. Is this an appendix? If it is, I could be a goner. And that was when I saw a ship one night, came within a quarter of a mile. I called him up with the orders lamp, I held up a flare, I fired a distress rocket, went straight past. And I thought, you know, as I saw it disappear, I thought, that may be the last I ever see of a fellow human. You know, I may be going to die from this.
With his radio intermittently playing up, remember, this was a generation before reliable satellite communications, Knox Johnson was unable to call for help, even if he'd wanted to. And in any case, many of the competitors on this first round-the-world race found radio contact with home a laborious and ultimately depressing exercise. Che Blythe.
What you have to remember is that in the radio, in the dim days, of course, you used to get a call and you had to book a call long beforehand. And so you'd book one for the next day. And at 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock or whatever time you'd booked, Porus Head, who had some fantastic operators, would be looking for you all over the place and they would bounce around. And they used to use different aerials and they'd bounce from one aerial to the next. You and Tun were doing what they call a tuning call and you had to tune out for them to try and get you. And many's the time you didn't get that particular call. The result was you didn't have a call for maybe 2 or 3 days' time. And so it'd be pot luck you'd get them again.
Hello, Baldock, my Azuru uniform whiskey.
I think it's the contrast between the normalcy of their lives and what they're doing and the fact that that isn't what you've got. For a moment, you're rejoining them via the radio. And then you're cut off. And they're going out to the pub and having a drink or whatever. You're not. You're still working a boat. You've got that contrast between your prison conditions, really. You know, 10.5 months with hard labour is what you've got. In fact, if you gave prisoners that, there'd be a public outcry. And the normalcy of what they're doing. And it's just that reminder, which, frankly, you're better forgetting. So it isn't a daily reminder. I used to keep my music for after that, just to cheer me up.
While Knox Johnson raised his spirits singing from Gilbert and Sullivan, at the back of the field, Donald Crowhurst's spirits were sinking. Craig Rich again.
He realised very soon, and he may have even realised before he sailed, but once he'd been out there for a few days, the boat wasn't up to it. The fact that the weather was bad convinced him fairly early on as well. And I just think that at that stage, he had to decide on one of two courses of action.
One was to give up, the other to cheat. A simple statement, but mind-bogglingly complex in its execution, entailing two sets of navigational calculations, one to plot a real course, the other to work backwards from an imaginary path and produce readings plausible enough to enter into the logbook he knew would be scrutinised on his return by experts like Rich. There were clues to the dilemma in the more introspective of Crowhurst's onboard recordings.
Close similarities between sailing a small boat and living. You start off unprepared, with a long journey ahead of you that you think will never end. And you go through a series of triumphs and disasters. And suddenly you realise that you're coming very close to the end. The interminable ages that seem to stretch before you at the start gallop by in the middle portion of the voyage. And you suddenly realise that it's finished.
If the race and life itself were inextricably linked for Crowhurst, for Bernard Mortessier, it was nothing. Contemptuous of the Sunday Times from the outset, the further he sailed Joshua, the more he realised the folly of competition, and after rounding Cape Horn, he decided to continue round the world for a second time. Mortessier died of cancer in 1994, but his fellow competitors recall a man truly at one with himself and the sea.
Bernard was a bit of a mistake, and he, I think in his own words, couldn't face the bullshit of coming back.
His arguments were, you know, well, I'm quite comfortable as I am. I've got enough money. You know, what do I want to land there? What do I want to be a hero for? What is ridiculous about our life? We buy a new car every year. You know, why do we change it? What's the meaning of this?
Moitessier's self-imposed retirement dispelled any remaining doubt that Knox Johnson would win. And the Englishman sailed into Falmouth Harbour on April the 22nd, 1969. 313 days after setting off.
I could have got in quite early on the morning. I was riding the Lizard and the boat came up and said, Robin, what time are you going to finish? And I said, it looks like it'll be about 9 o'clock. And then they came back at me and said, look, do you mind slowing up? I said, why? And they said, well, the mayoress is going to be greeting you and she's arranged to have her hair done at 9. So would you mind slowing up so she can be there, you know? So I said, yes, all right. I mean, all I wanted in the following order was a beer, a steak and a bath. As you're coming in towards the finish line, you're surrounded by boats. And you're worried about these boats. What are they going to do? And, you know, keep out of my way. The BBC boat actually hit me. But, you know, you're trying to dodge all these boats, getting in the way, and you're talking to people, and that's great, and that's exciting, and it's fun, but you're still thinking, there's the finish, I need to get across this finish line, let's get the boat in, let's moor her up, let's get her safe. And so you venture across the finish line, and it's a great moment. But now what's going to happen? You know, how are we going to moor my boat? Fine, you know, wave to people, yes, but look, wait a minute, what's happening to my boat? Let's get the boat sorted out first. So your mind's on that, and then the customs come on board, and... Actually, it was great, because they jumped on board and they said, good afternoon, Captain, where from? And I just was able to give them a classic answer, Falmouth.
News of Knox Johnson's achievement would have come as a hammer blow to Crowhurst, whose only hope now was to win the prize for the fastest circumnavigation. He began making even more extravagant claims of progress, claims that forced Nigel Tetley, just ahead of him, to push his trimaran, Victorious, even harder, according to Craig Rich.
I think Victorious could have done it and could have won it for Tetley if it hadn't been for the fact that when he was off the Azores and nearing home, he had a message to tell him that Crowhurst was close behind him, enclosing, and Nigel pushed the boat and it sunk because he pushed it too hard. And suddenly Crowhurst realises he can't lose the race.
Apart from the odd gale, it'll be a downhill run to England. No problems at all, I shouldn't think. Anyway, I certainly feel as though the voyage is over. Although I've got about 2,000 miles or so to go. Barring catastrophes, the whole thing's sewn up at this stage. I feel as though I can realise all those ambitions I nurtured as a boy, like playing cricket for England, you know, feel on top of the world, tremendously fit. And I feel in tremendous shape. I've never felt so.
At this point, the tape ran out, and soon, so would Donald Crowhurst's life. What the upbeat public recording failed to capture was his torment at being exposed as a cheat, a torment that only became clear when Tynemouth Electron was found drifting in the Atlantic, 1,800 miles southwest of England, 10 weeks after Knox Johnson's victory. Of Crowhurst, there was not a trace, except for an increasingly rambling series of entries in the logbook he'd left, as if waiting for it to be discovered.
The system is shrieking out this message at the top of its voice. Why does no one listen? I am listening anyway.
Nature does not allow God to sin any sins except one. That is the sin of concealment. This is the terrible secret of the torment of the soul needed by a natural system to keep trying. He has perpetrated this sin on the tormented.
He chose a moment in time to commit suicide and just literally just walk over the boat. It's quite interesting to say, right, at 3:30, whatever time it was, I'm going to call it a day. So his mind had obviously sort of gone on.
The tragedy is, he wasn't a big enough man to say, look, that's it. I've done pretty well and I'm coming home.
With the news of Crowhurst's death, Robin Knox Johnson was confirmed as not only the first, but also the fastest to complete a single-handed non-stop circumnavigation, and with it, the £5,000 prize from the Sunday Times. A few days later, Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon and grabbed every headline. But be it outer space or the great wide oceans, those who proceed unprepared are mad. Only two of the nine sailors were properly prepared, and when one carried on sailing around the world, the winner was a patriotic Englishman who had prepared himself and his boat for every eventuality.